All right, we'll let the musicians go down at this time, unless they're participating in some special music here this morning, while you're turning in your Bibles to the Gospel of Luke, chapter 23. All right, out of respect for the Word of God, let's stand together as I begin reading there with verse 1. And the whole multitude of them arose and led him unto Pilate. And they began to accuse him, saying, "We found this fellow perverting the nation and forbidding to give tribute to Caesar, saying that he himself is Christ the King." And Pilate answered him, saying, "Art thou the King of the Jews?" And he answered him and said, "Thou sayest it." Then said Pilate to the chief priest and to the people, "I find no fault in this man." And they were the more fierce, saying, "He stirreth up the people, teaching throughout all Jewry, beginning from Galilee to this place." When Pilate heard of Galilee, he asked whether the man were a Galilean. And as soon as he knew that he belonged unto Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him to Herod, who himself also was at Jerusalem at that time. And when Herod saw Jesus, he was exceeding glad, for he was desirous to see him of a long season, because he had heard many things of him, and he hoped to have seen some miracle done by him. And he questioned with him in many words, but he answered him nothing. And the chief priest and scribes stood and vehemently accused him. And Herod, with his men of war, set him at naught and mocked him and arrayed him in a gorgeous robe and sent him again to Pilate. And the same day Pilate and Herod were made friends together, for before they were at enmity between themselves.
Now, last week we discussed the facts surrounding the longest and darkest night in history. It was a night in which the injustice and cruelty of man was on full display. It began with Jesus and his disciples in the upper room for the Last Supper. And then they went to Gethsemane. And then they were betrayed, or he was betrayed by Judas. And then finally arrested and brought to an illegal late-night trial at the palace of the high priest. We discussed why that trial was illegal last Sunday. He was beaten and abused through the night while the religious leaders decided what they were going to do with Jesus now that he was in their power. Because of the Passover, their time was short. They needed to get Jesus convicted at dawn and get him killed before 6 o'clock that evening. That time was important because that was the beginning of the Sabbath day, the high holy Sabbath day, which is why they had to take Jesus off the cross as they did, because no one could hang on a cross or be executed on those holy days. Now, why didn't they simply kill Jesus on the spot? They had him in their power. Why not simply execute Jesus and be done with it? Why bring the Romans into the situation? I'll give you four reasons. Number one, they wanted to blame the Romans for Jesus' death. They didn't want the crowd, the multitude, rising up against them. They wanted to be able to say, "Hey, listen, he committed crimes against Rome, and Rome killed him. Our hands are innocent of this. What could we do against the Romans?" And so they wanted to put him in the Romans' hands so that they could pass the blame to the Romans with the people. And then secondly, they wanted to turn Rome against Jesus' followers, possibly even outlawing Christianity altogether. And then thirdly, they wanted to terrify their fellow Jews from ever identifying with Jesus. And then fourthly, because once the Romans were involved, there was nothing that any of Jesus' sympathizers or followers could do to change the situation. Once Jesus is in Pilate's hands and surrounded by Roman soldiers, there's no way he could be rescued, delivered. Once it's in Rome's power, there's no remedy to the situation. And so those are the four reasons why they didn't simply execute Jesus or murder him at night. But you know, there was a fifth and greater reason, and that is the providence of God. That God, in His wisdom, had moved all these circumstances around so that Jesus would die on the cross of Calvary that day, and all of man's plans were inadvertently fulfilling the plan of God for Jesus Christ. Now this morning we're going to see Jesus as the perfect substitute. We're going to look at three men who came into the presence of Jesus Christ that day and were never the same after. I call them the cynic, the sinner, and the seditionist. Notice first, Pilate, Pontius Pilate, the cynic. Now Pilate was the governor of Judea from 26 to 36 AD. As governor, he was responsible for the military, with keeping the peace, with collecting taxes, and with some limited judicial functions. He was the governor when John the Baptist began preaching. He was the governor when Jesus began preaching. And he was the governor when Jesus was killed and rose from the dead. And he was also the governor in the earliest days of the Church of Jerusalem. Now, as the Roman governor, his office was not in Jerusalem. He lived in Caesarea, the Roman city. And he spent most of his time up there in that Roman enclave where he was surrounded by his people. And he didn't like the Jews very much. He liked to keep a distance. He only went down to Jerusalem when it was necessary to do his job. Most of the time, he preferred to stay in the Roman city, the Roman capital of Caesarea, and let the Jews take care of their own business. But he was somewhat of a tyrant. Now, you read the gospel accounts and you're almost tempted to have sympathy for Pilate, but when you study Pilate in secular history, you find that he was a murderer, he was an oppressor, he was a man who abused his power, he was a man who flaunted Jewish traditions, and because of that, he was hated by the Sanhedrin, he was hated by the Jewish people. And by the way, aren't we going to find some strange bedfellows in this chapter? I mean, people that don't like each other. I mean, the Sanhedrin hates Pilate. Pilate doesn't like the Sanhedrin. But they're going to find themselves working together against Jesus. Pilate and Herod, they don't like each other. But as soon as Herod sends Jesus back wearing that robe as a joke, Pilate must have thought that was funny because they became friends from that point forward. You find strange bedfellows when it comes to Jesus Christ. And by the way, a lot of forces out there that don't like each other, they find common ground in hating Jesus Christ and hating the Bible and hating Christianity. Strange bedfellows. Now, Pilate had come down to the city of Jerusalem because of the Passover feast day. There were probably 300,000 Jews in the city at that time. And he came down with a single legion of soldiers just to make sure that nothing got out of hand, just to make sure that there were no uprisings or revolutionary talk. He was there just to keep the peace, the Pax Romana, the Roman peace, at the tip of a sword if necessary. And the last thing that Pilate wanted was any trouble. He wanted to go down to Jerusalem, be ignored by the Jews, make sure nothing happened around the feast days, see that everyone went home, and then he was going to go back to Caesarea, back to where he liked to be, where he could go to his Colosseum and he would watch the horse races and go to the circus and all the sort of things that they had there in the city of Caesarea. Now, the last thing he wanted was what he found waiting in his office that morning. For when he arrived at his judgment hall, for what he hoped would be a normal day, he found a mob of Jewish leaders waiting with a beaten and bloodied prisoner in their midst. Now, the Sanhedrin accused Jesus of sedition and treason. They said in verse 2, "We found this fellow perverting the nation and forbidding to give tribute to Caesar, saying that he himself is Christ a king." Now these were serious charges punishable by crucifixion, but they were false charges. Jesus had not tried to set up a kingdom. He had not declared himself a king. There was one time where the people tried to make him a king and he snuck away to avoid being made a king. And the only thing that Jesus had ever said about the Romans was, "Give to God that which is God's, give to Caesar that which is Caesar's." He had not said anything that was seditious. He had not said anything that was treasonous. He had not tried to set up an earthly kingdom. But they were accusing him of these things so that he would be quickly put to death. And what they were really hoping for was a quick rubber stamp. Just set it on Pilate's desk, rubber stamp it, and take him out of here. That's what they were hoping for. The problem was that Pilate didn't like them. Pilate didn't like them at all. And he was not exactly willing to give them whatever they wanted. And so we're going to find Pilate caught between a rock and a hard place. He is amazed at Jesus' silence in verses 2 through 5. In verse 3, "Art thou the king of the Jews?" And he answered him and said, "Thou sayest it." I think that "thou sayest it" is similar to saying that is what is being said, or that is what I am accused of. And so he's not really giving an answer. He's giving an answer, but it's kind of like, well, that's what everyone is saying. That's what the accusation is. But Jesus would not defend himself. That's what's amazing to Pilate. That here's a man facing crucifixion. Why aren't you begging and pleading and stating your case? Why aren't you trying to say anything to get yourself out of this situation? Now, he is shrewd enough, Pilate is shrewd enough to know that the envy behind the Sanhedrin was envy. That was their motivation, was envy. You find that in another gospel. And he tells them in verse 4, he said, "I find no fault in this man." Now, Pilate was between a rock and a hard place. On one side, he has a sense of Roman justice. The Romans prided themselves on their justice. And he knows this is an innocent man. He also has, he's on another side, he's got Roman superstition. The Romans were an exceedingly superstitious people. And his wife sent a note to him, kind of a text message of the time, said, "Have nothing to do with this man. I have suffered many things in a dream because of him tonight." Well, the Romans, when you get people had dreams, very superstitious about their dreams. So on one side, he's got Roman justice. This man is innocent. Then he has Roman superstition. His wife had a dream, I would hate for to have karma or something come back on me because of this. And then on the other hand, he has Roman practicality. The Romans were an extremely practical people. And Roman practicality said, why should I have any trouble with this one Jewish peasant? What is his life to me? I can make all these leaders happy. I can score some political points. And if you see the other Gospels and see the parallel accounts, they were even got to the point where they said, if you do not kill this man, you are committing treason against Caesar. So now he's in a position where I've got to protect myself. I can please these leaders. This Jew, one Jew, what is he to? So Roman practicality on the other hand. And we know where Pilate ends up making his decision. Now, let's go to John chapter 18. I do want to see one parallel passage here in John chapter 18, because Jesus did say several things to Pilate. He never defended himself, but he did have a short conversation with him. Notice in John chapter 18 and verse 33. John 18, 33. Then Pilate entered into the judgment hall again and called Jesus and said unto him, "Art thou the king of the Jews?" Jesus answered him, "Sayest thou this thing of thyself, or did others tell it thee of me?" Pilate answered, "Am I a Jew? Thine own nation and the chief priests have delivered thee unto me. What hast thou done?" Jesus answered, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then would my servants fight, that I should not be delivered to the Jews. But now is my kingdom not from hence." Pilate therefore said unto him, "Art thou a king then?" Jesus answered, "Thou sayest that I am a king. To this end was I born, and for this cause came I into the world, that I should bear witness unto the truth. Every one that is of the truth heareth my voice." Pilate saith unto him, "What is truth?" And when he had said this, he went out again unto the Jews, and saith unto them, "I find in him no fault at all." Now, what I'd like for you to see this morning is that it is not really Jesus on trial. It is Pilate on trial. See, Jesus, his end is already determined. He knows he's going to the cross. It is Pilate that is being put in the position of making a decision. He is a man who is caught in history and caught in providence. His decision will never be forgotten. He has the opportunity to do the right thing, but instead he does what is expedient for himself. He has the power to do right, but he chooses to do wrong. Now someone asked me, "Preacher, how, if it was God's will and plan for Jesus to go to the cross, then is Pilate really responsible for his decision?" And the answer is, yes, he is. Because Jesus said about Judas Iscariot that it had been better for him if he'd never been born. So though Judas, his betrayal was part of God's plan, Judas was still held responsible for the decision that he made to betray Jesus. And Pilate here is also going to be held responsible for the decision he makes concerning Jesus Christ. He chose the expedient pathway for himself. He ignored justice. He turned over a man that he knew was innocent. He had been warned by his wife. He knew the right thing to do, but he chose the wrong thing to do for his own benefit. Pilate was a cynic. He'd been a politician all of his life. You know the problem with political jokes? They get elected. Pilate was a politician. Now, he wasn't elected up from the people. He was appointed down from the emperor and his councils. He was a bureaucrat. He had an appointed position. And his task at that time was to govern Judea. He was going to be moved later. They would move these governors around, much like sending an ambassador here for a short time and then moving him to some other cabinet position. But he was a bureaucrat who lived for Rome and served the emperor. As long as he did his job and there was peace, he enjoyed many benefits for himself. And he knew how to play the game. He was cynical. He told Jesus what is truth, and then he did not wait for an answer to his question. Jesus said, "They that are of the truth hear my voice." Pilate said, "What is truth?" And he walked away. You see, Pilate did not believe in truth. Pilate had become cynical. He had traveled the world. He had seen things. He had been in politics. And he had seen various world religions. And he had become cynical towards the whole thing. No longer believed in absolute truth, if he ever had in the first place. He had seen the ins and outs and dirt of politics. He had seen the world religions and the various parts of regions that he had served in. He had enjoyed the pleasures of sin and been hardened by them. And now he is cynical towards the truth. You know, we start out as very curious creatures. We're full of faith. We believe things. We're full of optimism. Our faith is stronger when we're children than it often is when we're older. Isn't that true? Most people who get saved before age 18. Something happens to the heart after that. It gets hardened with time. I can't help but think about my dad. I don't know if he would agree with me, but I'm just looking back on my own childhood recollections. But I think that my dad had become very cynical after seeing the world in the Navy. My dad left his parents' home at 17, graduated from high school. A week later, he was on a Greyhound bus going to boot camp, and he served in the Navy for 24 years. And I'm proud of that. And he's proud of that, and he ought to be. But I just remember when I was a child growing up that we had no church, we had nothing spiritual, no Bible, no God, just a secular, materialistic family. My mother was what's called a lapsed Catholic. My dad promised the Catholic Church to raise me a Catholic so I could get baptized as a baby. He lied. I asked my mom recently, I said, did Dad have to take any special classes so I could get christened as a child? She said, yeah, he had to take a class. He had to promise to raise you as a Catholic. Then she texted me. She wrote in big letters, "He lied." And I said, "Good." I think the Lord will forgive him for that. But I remember my dad, he grew up a Southern Baptist. Going to Southern Baptist, my grandma took him to church. He and his sisters to church every week. went to revival meetings, the whole nine yards. But he said, as soon as I left home, he said, my shadow was never going to darken a church doorstep again. And he became very cynical. He saw what was out there. And he didn't find truth out there. He became cynical. And after I got saved, see, there was one path to my parents' heart. There was only one door to my parents' heart, and that was their son. When I got saved, and they began to see the change in my life, my parents got to church, came to church with me. My mom got saved. My dad started coming back to church, came back around to his childhood faith, got saved, and they're serving in church this morning. They serve in the nursery together and take care of all those little children together. And so I think of Pilate in a similar way. Here's a man who started out perhaps with some faith and some things, but he's jaded now and he's selfish and he's hardened by sin and he's got his cushy job and doesn't want anything interfering with his job. And here these Jews have brought this peasant carpenter in, and why should I do what is right when I can do what is expedient? And what is truth? There is no truth. The only truth I'm concerned about is what's good for Pilate. He made his decision based on that. Say, folks, you can go out and see the world, but you're not going to find the truth out there in the world. Out there in the world, you find confusion and cynicism and doubts and ambiguity. It is only in this book that we find the truth. And if you or someone perhaps listening to this online has gone and seen the world and now your faith is shot to pieces, I challenge you to come back to the Bible where the truth is found. Come back to Christ. Everyone that is of the truth hears His voice. Listen to what Jesus said. Don't just turn a cynical ear and walk away from Christ without hearing all that He might have to say. And so Pilate is far more concerned. He does not want to make the decision concerning Jesus Christ, but he's going to have to. He's not going to get out of it. He's going to try, but he's going to have to make the decision concerning Jesus Christ. And every person must one day make the decision concerning Jesus Christ. You can surround yourself with a wall of cynicism. It's easy in our society to wall yourself off from any church or any Christian influence. But every person must one day make the decision concerning Jesus Christ. And not making the decision is a decision. It's a decision to reject. So Pilate is going to have to make the decision, but he's Pilate the cynic. Now notice secondly, the sinner, King Herod. Back in Luke 23 and verse 8, when Herod saw Jesus, Pilate found out that he was from Galilee. He said, oh man, I can pass this guy off. Here's my first chance to get out of this situation. I'm going to send him to Herod. Let Herod take care of this. And so he sent him off to King Herod. Now, verse number 8 again, when Herod saw Jesus, he was exceeding glad. For he was desirous to see him of a long season, because he had heard many things of him, and he hoped to have seen some miracle done by him. Now this Herod was one of the terrible family, the Herod family, one of the wickedest families in the history of the world. His father, Herod the Great, had ordered the massacre of the babies of Bethlehem when Jesus was born. This Herod, Herod Antipas, had seduced his brother's wife away and married her, had imprisoned John the Baptist and then had him executed. And the reason he had John executed was because he was lusting over his own stepdaughter and made a rash vow. So we're not dealing with a decent human being here. We're dealing with a man with blood dripping off his hands and lust filling his heart. A very wicked, ungodly, hardened sinner. That's Herod. This King Herod has been wanting to see Jesus for some time, not because he's interested in him as Messiah, but because he hopes he can do some magic tricks that might impress him. He begins asking Jesus questions, not because he wants to learn, but he's interrogating Jesus, mocking Jesus. And Jesus says not a word to Herod. Now that's interesting, because Jesus said a few things to Pilate, but not one word to Herod. Not even one attempt to try to reach Herod. Because I believe Herod was a reprobate. Herod wasn't going to get saved. Is it possible biblically for a person to pass a deadline and pass a point at which they're just not going to get saved? The Bible does talk about reprobate minds, reprobate hearts. Now, does that mean that God was never willing to save that person? No. But the heart can become so hardened in sin that it no longer feels conviction, it can no longer repent, and it will never turn to Christ for salvation. Now, you and I don't know when a person is reprobate. It may be that the guy in prison can get saved and the business executive can't. You think about that. Here's a king, and Jesus doesn't even try to say one word that might win him over. Now, this man's hardened. He's not going to get saved. Notice what he does to Jesus in verse 11. And Herod with his men of war set him at naught and mocked him and arrayed him in a gorgeous robe and sent him again to Pilate. Now, he questioned Jesus, but not sincerely. He ridicules Christ in his questions. Many today, they ask questions, but they really don't want to hear the answers. And when they do ask questions, it's only to try to make a fool of you. Y'all ever dealt with anyone like that? Some of us are related to people like that. They don't ask questions because they want a sincere answer. They ask questions because they think you're stupid and they're trying to prove to you that you're stupid for believing in Christ. And Herod is asking those kind of questions of Jesus. And Jesus will not even dignify his questions with an answer. They began to mock him. Notice they said they set him at naught. What does that mean? They treated him like he was nothing. And a lot of folks today treat Jesus like he is nothing. They make a mockery of him. They set him at naught. And then he took a gorgeous robe and threw it over the shoulders of Jesus. And his soldiers beat on him. That's in another gospel. Beat on him for a little while. And then they mocked him and they bowed their knee before him and said, "Hail the King of the Jews." Oh, they had a great time making fun of Jesus. A lot of people in our society, they have a lot of fun making fun of Jesus, making fun of his church, making fun of Christian people. And then he sent him back to Pilate, still wearing that gorgeous robe. But see, Herod, one day the tables will be turned. You see, Herod went on his way in his reprobate lifestyle, but then all of his political power went away. He was sent off to exile. He died as a pauper. And he split hell wide open. And he's still in hell today. While I'm standing here preaching, the man who laughed at Jesus and mocked him and said, "Hey, put a purple robe on him," that same man is crying out for one drop of water and he'll never get it. Tables will turn. So, those who mock Jesus today and set him as naught, you and I can have pity upon them. Because one day they're going to breathe their last breath. The breath that God holds in his hand, the heartbeat that beats according to God's will one day stop. And eternity is way too long to be wrong. I want you to notice, thirdly, we've seen the cynic and the sinner. How about the seditionist, Barabbas? Verse 12. This is the same day Pilate and Herod made friends together. And that tells us a little bit about Pilate, because when Jesus comes back wearing this gorgeous robe, it was a joke between Herod and Pilate thought it was pretty funny. Doesn't it? Oh, Herod. I didn't know Herod had such a good sense of humor. From that day forward, they were friends. What a good joke, wearing a gorgeous robe, wearing Herod's robe. Ha ha ha, funny, funny. And from that day forward, they became good friends. Now notice in verse 13. Pilate, when he called together the chief priests and the rulers of the people, said unto them, "Ye have brought this man unto me as one that perverteth the people. Behold, I, having examined him before you, have found no fault in this man touching those things whereof you accuse him. No, nor yet Herod, for I sent you to him, and lo, nothing worthy of death is done unto him. I will therefore chastise him and release him." Now, there is his second attempt to get out of the situation, but he's not being just. If the man is innocent, why scourge him? Right? He's just trying to compromise. That's what politicians do. Trying to compromise. We don't have to kill him. I'll just beat his back bloody. I'll have him scourged within an inch of his life, and then I'll let him go. That was not just, but that was a compromise. Then he had a tradition. Verse 17 says, "For of necessity he must release one unto them at the feast." Pilate did one thing every year to try to please the Jews. He would take one of his prisoners and release him back to the people as a sign of goodwill. And so Pilate now is going to make his third attempt to escape this situation. He sends off to his dungeons to find the very worst prisoner there, a man who's going to be executed that very day, Barabbas, a man who had caused insurrection in the city, had raised sedition against Rome, and had even killed someone in the process, had committed murder. I'm going to drag him out, and I'll give the people the choice between Barabbas, the murdering seditionist, or Jesus, and I'll let them decide, and I'll pass the buck to them. I mean, this was no hero of the people that he brought out. This is a man who was a murderer, a seditionist, and he said, surely they won't choose this man over Jesus. Now, can you imagine being in a courtroom and the judge says, you know what, I really don't want to make a decision on this court case. I'm going to go ahead and let the people in the audience decide. What do you think, guilty or not guilty? There's no justice there. And in verse 18, they cried out at once, saying, "Away with this man and release unto us Barabbas." Pilate is shocked. Notice verse 20, Pilate, therefore willing to release Jesus, spake again to them, but they cried, saying, "Crucify him, crucify him." He said unto them the third time, "Why? Why? What evil hath he done? I find no cause of death in him. I'll therefore chastise him and let him go." Can't you be happy with just some blood being shed? Does he have to be crucified? And the voices of them and the chief priests prevailed. Now you know why? Because there wasn't anyone there that wasn't against Jesus. Jesus' friends were not there, folks. This was a midnight trial, a hasty dragging him in before. Jesus' friends were still in the city. They were not there at the trial, at this appearance before Pilate. And so the chief priests, they got everyone together. "Crucify him, crucify him. Turn over Jesus and have him killed and let Barabbas go." Verse 24, Pilate gave sentence that it should be as they required. And he released unto them him that for sedition and murder was cast into prison, whom they had desired. But he delivered Jesus to their will. And of course, the other Gospels tell us that he took a basin of water and made this symbolic show of washing his hands. But Pilate could wash his hands, but he couldn't wash his heart. Because he had done the wrong thing. Now, Barabbas became a picture of you and I. Can you imagine Barabbas sitting on death row? His trial's over. He's condemned. He's going to die that day. It was his cross that Jesus bore. Can you imagine his last night, the day, the hours ticking by as he is sitting there thinking in the dungeon? They're going to scourge my back and just feel the lashes. What's it going to feel like when they drive those spikes into my hands and my feet? Dreading. He's seen people die. The cross is dropped in place. The joints pop out. They hang there and try to gasp for breath. Knowing that people that were crucified sometimes lived for days in agony. Birds would come down and begin picking at their flesh and picking at their eyes. The crowd standing by jeering. He's thinking about it and then dying. Where will I go when I die? I've committed murder and sedition. I'm a sinner. What will happen to me? Will I be in hell? And the next thing he knows, he's being released and someone else is taking his place. And we don't know anything else about Barabbas except that he was condemned and destined to die a terrible death, and Jesus died on his cross. Can I tell you, he also died on my cross because I was the sinner that Jesus died for also. I don't know if Barabbas ever got saved. I don't know if Barabbas ever became a Christian. The Bible does not tell us. I hope that he did. I hope that he said, "Who is this man that's taking my place?" I hope that he heard Peter preach on Pentecost. I hope that he got born again. But he certainly represents the sinner who has had a substitute take his place. Christ took my place. He died my death. And I don't have to sit around at night thinking about what will happen if I die. Will I burn in hell? What's going to happen to me? Because I have assurance that I'm saved through Jesus Christ. And heaven is my home. I never worry about hell for myself. Not because I'm a great person, but because I'm a saved person. And Jesus died in my place. And you don't have to worry about hell any longer if you turn to Christ as your Savior and let Him be your substitute. Because He's already died for you. But you must receive Him into your heart to receive the benefit of that and be saved. Barabbas, the seditionist, but he had the perfect substitute in Jesus Christ.